Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and what inspiration we can find in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are concluding our series on the myths and legends of Hawaii. But honestly, I feel like there's so much more to explore, and I hope that this season, you know, more than anything else, has inspired people to learn a little more about the culture of this part of the world, which is not something that I think is kind of broadly taught. I mean, at least certainly I never really studied that much about it in school. We did a section on basically the process by which Hawaii became part of the U.S., but we didn't really talk much about the culture of it other than that. And I would imagine outside the United States, it's even less so. So having come to the end of this section, what have we learned? You know, this is the first season in which we discussed a pantheon not present in Deities and Demigods, and I have to say, you know, I am quite critical of that book, I think for fair reason, but I try not to let that criticism stray into criticism of Jim Ward specifically, who I think really was being asked to do the impossible, translate all of world religion into D&D terms. It was a fool's errand in the first place, and doubly so in the 1970s. I've said it before, I don't know what kind of resources were available to a small town teacher in the 1970s about, say, Chinese religion in a language that he could read. Now, as it happens, I think the Deities and Demigods section on China is exceptionally bad, even by those limitations, but those limitations would have prevented it probably from really being comprehensive. I don't know, well, it's hard to say, of course, but I do feel like trying to do a section myself has made problems that I understood theoretically feel a little bit more real. How do you know that the information you're getting is good? Are there good sources available? If there are a lot of good sources available, how do you condense that into a usable form? You know, what do you opt to include or not include? Like, I think that these are questions that one can struggle with in good faith. Doing it myself has kind of helped to bring that home a little bit. And I don't think that I've done more than kind of scratch the surface or provide an overview of the wealth of Hawaiian lore out there. You know, even as I wrap up the series, I'm always finding new stuff in my reading. That Kupua episode could have been multiple times its length. There are just so many different heroes and different stories about them. And I didn't really talk about the mythology in a strictly religious context very much either. That is to say, what do these sacred stories mean to people in their daily lives? You know, how do they affect what life is like. And I think when you have a civilization that maybe we don't know as much about, like, not that I'm saying that most people are experts on ancient Mesopotamia or early medieval Scandinavia or ancient Greece or whatever, but I do think that there's even less that we are presented with in the media that has, you know, any relation, accurate or not, to Hawaiian culture. So I feel like we spent some time on the context, but probably could have done more. One of the things that I thought was really interesting, and this is something, again, something that I always say, something that I'm aware of, but it was interesting how much it was kind of brought home in the Hawaiian section, is how much societies don't necessarily care about the kinds of things that an outsider might expect. So, you know, these myths do teach and express cultural values, but not always in a plainly, like, explanatory or didactic way. And even if the myths do present certain cultural values as sort of immutable truths, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's how people experience them in real life. Okay, to pick an obvious example, a lot of Hawaiian myth is concerned with establishing genealogy. Right? Genealogy is a major component of a lot of these texts, and a lot of the time I have skipped it. But there's a transition from kind of fantastical into historical genealogy. And it's concerned with situating existing political and social structures in a kind of sacred order. Not a timeless one necessarily, because the idea of this kind of change and evolution over time is an important part of genealogy as history, right? Westerners, if we can use that term for people who honestly live east of Hawaii, tended to typecast Hawaiians as sort of carefree and relaxed. Think about, for instance, the wailing song Old Maui, which presents Maui as a place of carefree relaxation for sailors who've done a bunch of cold, hard work. And in particular, which, I mean, you know, in a very minor way, stresses the island as a kind of like paradise, a tropical place where there are beautiful women and plenty of time to relax. Of course, for those sailors, that was true-ish. But I think it's a stereotype of a lot of Pacific Island societies that remains part of modern culture because, of course, it's useful to people who are primarily interested in selling these places as tourism destinations. And many 19th century writers and 20th century writers see Hawaii, as I said, as carefree and relaxed, basically meaning that, like, you know, they don't wear neckties or whatever. Obviously, that is not really true, as we said when we discussed the fish ponds thing and the surfing thing. And of course, a common view claimed that colonialism was justified because colonial powers, quote unquote, improved the land, right? That they managed it productively, unlike indigenous people who would just, I don't know, lie around eating coconuts in the sun or whatever. Like, that's not true on the face of it, and even if it were, it wouldn't justify dispossessing these people of their land, but that was a pretty widespread view. Indeed, remains a fairly widespread view. I saw a fella talking about it on Twitter just the other day. Not that guy who thought that sometimes it gets too hot to think, but a different person who was arguing that colonialism was cool because the labor theory of value means that the land is owned by whoever improves it the most, which I don't think is the labor theory of value, but never mind. I think this is also a view that comes from a Eurocentric worldview. You know, that word Eurocentrism has kind of gone out of fashion in recent years, and I understand why. And I will say that Eurocentrism is not necessarily, I mean, it depends what you mean by centrism, but a worldview that sees things in terms of their relationship to the seer is fine as long as you acknowledge that that's what it is, right? My worldview is centered on Great Britain because that is where I am. You just have to sort of be critical of your own temptation to see places outside your frame of reference as, like, exotic or different other than to you. If your worldview is centered on Great Britain, then your sense of Hawaii is likely to be focused on the ways in which it is different from Great Britain. Things like the climate, or the volcanoes, or people not wearing shirts a lot of the time, or whatever. But that kind of focusing on differentiation can lead to these stereotypes, and accepting these stereotypes allows, you know, the people who want to turn your village into a sugar plantation or whatever to get away with that kind of thing. Boy, that was a very long way around. I guess what I'm trying to say is that people are people, and legitimizing political institutions is something that a lot of religions, asterisk, do, you know, insofar as religions is a helpful term for things that don't have the kind of centralization or organization that would make them like an institution, which is the case in Hawaii. So on the one hand, when I engaged with the mythology of Hawaii, I found it to be very complex and confusing because I didn't have a lot of context for it. But I think that actually quite a lot of mythologies would seem more enigmatic to us if we encountered them in the way that Hawaiian religion is typically presented, which is beyond a few fragmentary stories and a couple of pop culture adaptations, your Moanas and what have you. Not that Moana is specifically Hawaiian, but there are elements of Polynesian folklore that do appear in Hawaii that are in Moana. Anyway, my point is, Greek mythology is actually weirder than you tend to think it is, but you feel like you have a context for understanding Greek mythology because you were presented with, you know, the Usborne Encyclopedia of Greek Myth when you were a kid, if you were like me. That makes those stories seem familiar, and Clash of the Titans does it, and Jason and the Argonauts, and, you know, whatever. Xena Warrior Princess, you know, all these things help give those stories a ring of familiarity, but there's a way to read them where that familiarity is taken away. The idea that those are familiar and therefore relatable to you, like you, is something that people, you know, had an interest in promoting, but I think that's, the jury is very much still out on that question. Same for Norse myth, right? Norse myth comes to us filtered not only through the Usborne Encyclopedia of Norse Mythology, but also through the fact that those texts were written by people who were familiar with the European medieval literary version of Greek mythology and wished to present Norse mythology in as Greek a way as possible. So what we're getting here is a set of myths that never really went through that filtering process to present them as a kind of literary whole to people who were not themselves Hawaiian. You know, the intended audience for the works of writers like Kamakua or Malo are fellow Hawaiians you know, converts to Christianity who are nonetheless interested in retaining the traditional literature and history of Hawaii. And that can sometimes mean that it feels hard to find an in. You know, one doesn't necessarily know where to start. I decided to start kind of cosmically because that is the format of deities and demigods, that I begin with the head of the pantheon, even though perhaps we may argue that there are historically pantheons that don't really have one of those. And if there is one here, it's Kane, so we started with Kane. Okay, I mean, fair enough. Does that really matter, though? I mean, I'm not trying to write a comparative religion thesis here. I just want to put some stuff in a fantasy game that encompasses a broader range of influences than just, you know, same old Thor, Odin, Zeus, whatever. My goal is not to simulate Hawaiian mythology or even name drop Hawaiian mythology, but to create an abstract version that allows me to play games in the same way that I create an abstract version for geography and language and economics and pole arms. But do think that it is a little different when you're dealing with something like the antiquities, the mythology of Hawaii, Kamo Olelo Hawaii, to use Malo's term, because of course there's this kind of colonial power imbalance. We know that this is a literary tradition that to some extent was a that was intentionally suppressed by the authorities in the name of, like, the standardization of getting everybody to speak English and so on and so forth. I feel like you have to be a little cautious. You have to try to be a little more respectful when dealing with that kind of thing. To me, the distancing effect is more respectful. I'm willing to entertain disagreements about that. Like, I'm not saying I have the right answer. Typically, I look at this and then I'm thinking, you know, these are interesting ideas. What inspiration can I find in them for my own creations rather than, cool, let's put coup in my game. Though I did put coup in my game at one point, so technically it wasn't coup. It was something created by a character in the game who was in turn inspired by Hawaiian mythology. So what are those things? You know, if I were looking at Hawaiian mythology as a whole, what are the key concepts that I would take from it to include in a game that I was running? I think the first is a thing that I talked about last episode, that idea of the mythologized landscape. The presence of the gods in the landscape or the presence of supernatural forces in the landscape is very prominent in Hawaiian mythology. It reminds me a little bit of some of the things that we have talked about in Japanese mythology, right? When we talked about Japan, the idea of having lots of like local traditions, local customs, local sacred sites, and local myths. That would be pretty interesting if you were doing a comparatively small scale fantasy game. Someone once pointed out to me, and I have not checked the map scale because it's not the kind of person I am, but I have not checked the map scale to confirm this, that if you go by the original scale of the maps of Glorantha, Sartar is about the size of County Durham in England, which is far too small. Others have suggested that Sartar be about the size of, they've proposed another interpretation of the map scale that makes Sartar about the size of, like, Northern Ireland, which, you know, historically could have multiple distinct polities within it. But that makes sense when you consider that those are cultures in which people don't, you know, they are aware of and they have cultural exchange with other, like, communities within their region, but they don't travel as much as we do today. People will tell you that, like, medieval people never left their homes or whatever. That's not really true. They did travel a certain amount for certain reasons, but they did not travel with the same ease or frequency that we do. I guess what I mean is, in a circumstance like that one, one can imagine that, like, localism becomes much more important, so that each distinct region. This is why I brought up Sartar, because, of course, it has all these sites where, like, magical things or sacred things happen or have happened in a comparatively small space. I think that that would happen here, too, particularly if you're dealing with a mountainous environment. Mind you, the sea is a highway, so, you know, swings and roundabouts. Next, kapu. Lots of rules to remember, rules to avoid, and rules to use. You know, tricking opponents into breaking kapu is super important. You know, learning all the kapu. It's a great opportunity for characters who, like, are religious specialists or ritual specialists to show off the importance of their skills. Lots of maritime stuff. I like the surfing contests that we see, or the number of times that someone, whether that's a goddess like Pele or a monster sees a young man surfing and decides to fall in love with him, the narrator decides for them to fall in love with him. They're good sea voyages and sea monsters. And connected to that, the idea of gods sailing away to like a physical place, right? Lano leaves Hawaii, but he doesn't like ascend into heaven. He gets on a boat and sails off to an unknown destination. That's present in other mythologies as well, but I do think that to a maritime culture, that sense that once somebody is beyond the horizon, you genuinely have no idea what's going on with them. It is very strong. Lano could come back tomorrow. He could come back in 10 years. He could never come back at all. And you don't know and you can't do anything about it. You can't even like send a guy to go look for him, really. I think your magical setting inspired by Hawaiian mythology can definitely have that sort of, you know, including different places, different islands, different whatever. It's a great way to explain why things are very different from each other, even across comparatively short travel times. I mentioned Pele, the powerful but jealous and demanding volcano goddess, is a, you know, maybe even more so than Maui or Ku, the aspect of Hawaiian mythology that has kind of like permeated Anglophone popular culture the most. But that's because it's a very powerful and memorable image. So I think definitely an idea worth emulating there. I think gods with many aspects is an idea, you know, so we've seen that there are many, many, many of these like different gods, but they're not really different gods. They're all just sort of different versions of Ku. And I think that you can do two things with that. Well, I'm sure you can do more than two, but here are two. One is that the different aspects of a deity, you know, you can have some connection within the clergy of that deity. Not that I think in Hawaiian mythology, the clergy of a certain deity saw themselves as like particularly closely connected to each other. But I think that's something that comes from institutional religion where those people will be part of the same organization, which obviously is not the case in pre-colonial Hawaii. But I do think that it's nice to have Kuka'ilimoku and Kuwaha'ilo in your game because they support, to my mind, the idea that the gods are larger than human comprehension, right? You might not be good and evil at the same time, but that's because you are immortal and your puny moral frame can't accommodate those kinds of contradictions. But Ku is divine and he can be the king authorizing deity of land and power and the maggot-spitting god of sorcerers at one and the same time, because he's not bound by your concepts of unity. And I think those sinister aspects are really helpful too, right? That idea that the moral concerns of the gods are on another axis altogether. It kind of solves the St. Cuthbert problem. Not that I have a very strong St. Cuthbert problem, but I do think that there's something about having these good gods that aren't really like omnipotent or anything in the fantasy universe that just kind of makes them Team Red and Team Blue, which is a bit boring. Clerics of St. Cuthbert out there fighting clerics of Grumsh, and it's just sort of, well, one side is good, one side is evil, and they're kind of imbalanced. Whereas the gods encompass both good and evil, and some are like more or less friendly to humanity, but they may just be friendly to other groups as well. And even Kuwaha'ilo is not like working for the downfall of humanity. He's just rewarding his own worshippers in a way that everybody else kind of frowns on. So in the comments for last episode, a listener who I've been calling Elias Helfer, who it occurs to me maybe Elias Helfer, sorry if that's the case, asked for a reading list. So the main text that I've been working with is Martha Warren Beckwith's Hawaiian Mythology. I picked it up real cheap on Kindle from University of Hawaii Press. It is very much a dip into kind of text. It is ordered sort of categorically, like by different deities and things. And part of my episode structure I have borrowed from Beckwith. So the focus on like doing an episode on Kupua, for example. The Kupua are kind of one big chapter of Beckwith. Beckwith has a maybe unfortunate tendency to kind of like these totalizing explanations. I told you, for instance, that I don't feel like I'm convinced by her understanding of the relationship between Ku and Hina, which seems to me to be maybe reading more into the stories than, not than is there, but then like would be the main focus of those stories. But nonetheless, I mean, it's still kind of the basic text and a lot of people refer to it. In a few cases, I've gone back and looked at the original sources used by Beckwith. I was able to download a copy of Malo's Antiquities of Hawaii, Kamo'olelo Hawaii. There's an English version that was published in 1903. I quoted from Adams's The Legend of Te Tuna. Now here, I think he's going with a version of the story of Maui's fight with the great eel Te Tuna, which is told in, I want to say in Tahiti. I probably said where it was. I also got some of my information on the creation of the Hawaiian Historical Society from a book called The Death of William Gooch by Greg Denning. It is not a book about like the history of Hawaii. It does have some stuff about the conflicts and politics of the unification era, you know, the wars around the reign of Kamehameha I, but that's not sort of its main focus. It's written in a way that I think very much addresses the concerns of academic historians or anthropologists, like often in quite theoretical ways. So I'm not recommending it, but it's interesting reading anyway. I mean, I think I got it for £1, possibly in the discount bookshelf outside Treadwell's in London. So, I mean, it's definitely worth £1. If you see it for £1, go ahead and buy The Death of William Gooch. That's about $1.25 to my American listeners. What else? Another thing that I did a lot was, I'm trying to take the position that there's not like an authorized version of any of these stories, right? There's not one right one and a bunch of wrong ones. These are stories that are multiple in the way that they're told. So a lot of the time I just went on YouTube and searched for, you know, Ku and Hina or Maui fights, whoever. And then I would just go look for videos in which that story was being told by a storyteller who was from Hawaii. I mean, that was really my main criterion, because I don't necessarily want to privilege one version of the story just because it happens to be in Beckwith or Malo, you know. I think if these stories are circulating, then they're changing, and then they're, you know, that's not any less valid than these older ones. And there are some, actually, kind of not as many as I had thought there would be. There's a lot of videos about mythology on YouTube, but most of them are just kind of regurgitating things you might find on, like, Wikipedia. But I do think that, but it surprised me a little because I had actually, in general, found pretty good resources available when doing the Native American section, including quite a lot of tellings of those stories, or some of them anyway, in their original languages. Whereas there were some for this, but not like a huge amount. And like I said, there was one that was from like the website of the National Breadfruit Council or whatever. And I think an openness to those kinds of versions of stories is important for two reasons. The first is I am not sure that I agree with the idea of authenticity in a spiritual or mythological setting that isn't some kind of historical reconstruction. Like, there's no reason that we should privilege that point in Hawaii's history over the current point in its history. But secondly, even if there were, it wouldn't matter to us because our purpose is not to go to a heiau and carry out some religious function to get a story of Kane and tell it in a way that people are going to think it's not just a story. Our goal is to clipe things for running fantasy RPGs, so it doesn't really matter what the authority behind the statement is. So I guess it could have been, which I guess makes my authenticity chasing a bit eh, but, you know, that's how I chose to approach it. Okay, that is about it for our Hawaiian mythology section. I learned a lot. I hope that you also found it interesting. There's still so much more that we haven't talked about, but I think it is now time for us to move on. As I said a few episodes ago, I'm going to put up the poll to choose the next section. And in the meantime, for the next two or three episodes, I think we're going to do some one-shots. We're going to look at a couple of different religious or mythological topics, but not go into full detail about any of them. So if you have a suggestion for one of those episodes, I'd love to see it in the comments. And then, based on what you choose in the survey, which will be going up on the Patreon site shortly, it may even be up by the time you hear this, we'll be beginning a new season of Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.